Okay, today is October 31st, 2014, and it's Karen Brewster and Dave Klein. And we were going to talk a little bit today about your work in Portugal and maybe some of your sabbatical work in Norway. Is that right?
We could do that. Yeah, I don't think that's what was my understanding, but anyway.
You go ahead with what your understanding.
But before we start out, I think...
You have a story to tell.
Yeah, it's about, you know, you got to see the lighter side of things. You got to see the lighter side of things. And you have to face up to aging. It's hard to do because most younger people think that when you get into your 80s, you've had all these experiences, and so you know all the answers about the future. But when you're 80, you've never experienced the 90s. and none of your friends that are younger than you know anything about that anyway. And they don't even know about the 80s because they've never been there. And so at any rate, I was... had my annual physical with the doctor, local doctor, and she, I'd had a, you know, some of the standard lab tests and everything, and so I said, well, all of this is, it looks like you're in pretty good shape for your age, and now I'm going to give you a cognitive test, which they now are doing for older people. And I said, well, okay. I wasn't prepared for this, but...
you hadn't studied for the test.
That's right, and that's you're not supposed to study for it. And so she said, I'm just going to read from this paper, and I want you to give answers quickly and not think too much about it. So she went through this whole thing, and early on she mentioned three items, and she said, I might come back to those later. And when she came back to those later, it was three items, simple items like a pencil or a fountain pen was one of them, and then the others were simple things that I can't remember, like dog or something. And so at any rate, then she went through the whole thing, and she said, well, here's the results. Said, you did fine. On everything, in fact, very good for your age, but you flunked one section. She has a good sense of humor, and she knows as a former professor, but flunking something is pretty bad. You flunked one section. And I said, oh, what section was that? And she says, that was short-term memory.
Uh-oh.
And I said, I already knew that. And I'm already doing something to compensate for it. And she said, what was that? But I can't afford it because I can't afford to buy so goddamn many sticky tapes to stick all everything. At any rate, she got a laugh and so did I.
That's good. Okay. So we are back now. Okay.
So we're ready to go again.
We're ready to go again. We're going to talk about Boy Scouts.
Well, yeah, because when I was a young guy, let's see, what age? I guess I remember from when we lived in Vermont, and I was really too young for Boy Scouts, and there was a little village where it was hard to organize a troop, but there was a regional troop, and my father was an assistant leader for the... He volunteered for that because he thought Boy Scouts was a good deal. And then we moved to Connecticut. And then when I lived in a small town near east of Hartford, on a little piece of land where we could have a garden and chickens and pets, and I had a goat, etc. But I joined a Boy Scout troop that was met in the basement of the church that my mother went to, and we went to as Sunday school students that stage in a family life, I should point out that my dad was at least a deist or maybe an agnostic, but he was very tolerant of religious beliefs, and my mom was fairly religious, but for a Protestant, and she wanted us kids to go to Sunday school and church until, according to the agreement she and my father had made, until we were 11 years old.
Oh, okay.
And then it was our choice as to whether we went to these deals. So at any rate, I wanted to be in Boy Scouts. My brother was in Boy Scouts. He's 2 years older. And yeah, it was a good experience. And the things that interested me most were camping and hikes. And this was when we lived in Connecticut. And those sort of how to do, build lean-tos and all about nature, living with nature, including how to trap, how the people, first trappers trapped with snares and other things, and how to set all these things. And so then I also volunteered after I'd been in the Scouts for a while and moved ahead in different grades from tenderfoot to first class and then star. And so then my ultimate goal was Eagle Scout, and I was volunteered to be a Cub Scout leader, where you met in some a home of somebody who, where the house mother was sort of had oversight over your activities with the kids, but you were like in charge of the meetings, and we'd do hikes with these young Cub Scouts and teach them the basics that, and say eventually would go into scouting. And I loved all that. I liked kids and younger kids and myself, and I was like kids in general and like scouting. And I didn't, those days we weren't all that fluent in, not fluent economically, let's say. We were recovering from, family was recovering from the Depression, even though it was a pre-war and jobs were paying more, and we were about this land, and life was, from my perspective, was great for the whole family. And I was the most oriented toward the land of my two siblings and older siblings. Although my brother was an ardent fisherman hunter, and he had had some of the advantages of Dad's instruction in those areas. But by the time I got old enough for that, then Second World War was on, and he was working night shifts, 12 hours, making a big salary, which helped to with this house and that was renting, he was renovating, and helped us to get financially stable as a family, and had to have a car to find a good car to get to work in Hartford, which was like about 12-hour drive. And so it was a negative for me in some respects that I didn't get Dad's influence so much as I had before. Although on the weekends we would have time together, but it was more chance. And we'd have one meal a day usually with him, the evening meal before he went to work, and it was the end of the day for us. And it was good. The family and my parents both felt that was all important, to that we had at least one meal a day where we sat down and could be together as a whole family. And those were, to me, it's one of the strongest things about a family relationship, not just that the parents were good parents, they were, but when we were together as a family, we could discuss these whole things, and all three of us children were there together too, and you know, you get a better feeling for we're all individuals, and sometimes, especially among us children, one would have interests that were quite different than the others, and that sometimes led to some conflicts, and parents were good at working us out or letting us work them out. Right. At any rate.
So how old were you when you started with the Boy Scouts then?
You had to be 12 years of age, I'm pretty sure, to be join the Boy Scouts. For the Cub Scouts, it was younger.
Right. But so you must have been around 12 then, because you didn't do Cub Scouts, did you?
No, I didn't do Cub Scouts, and partly because where I lived so rurally, it was hard when you're that small to do that, because how do you... You did this after school or and then on the weekends,
right,
if you did hikes, and you had to organize getting there, and that was a little problem for me as a Cub Scout leader, but I was could do that on the way home from school through that.
But when you guys lived in Vermont, when you were little, it was too hard to do Cub Scouts because
right,
you were too rural.
Yeah.
So what was it that inspired you about being in Boy Scouts? I mean, you talked about it was a big influence on you, and so I assume it means throughout the rest of your life. And so in what way?
Well, it was largely because I was fascinated with nature, with plants and animals, and especially natural vegetation and wildlife. And that's important in scouting. And, you know, you learn about how to track animals in the snow and things like that. And when you do the merit badges, then they have special merit badges that you can focus on your interest even more. And sometimes you do the studies and you work with a merit badge advisor as a local person, usually males, but not necessarily exclusively so then, about... the topic, they're sort of local experts on the topic.
Right.
And so then you do this project, and then if you qualify, they sign off for you and you get a merit badge. And then you have to accumulate these merit badges, and you have to have, I think, 21, a minimum of 21, in order to be an Eagle Scout. But there were some, like, core badges that you had to have, like... physical education was one, which included athletics, and that there was a lot of emphasis on training and performance. And there were others that you had that were basic, but then there were a lot of, you know, sort of like in schools or in the university, elective kinds of.
Right.
And so, yeah, and it was a, you know, you... At that age, you know, collecting a large number of merit badges was great. And you had a banner and your mom would sew these things on. And formal scout meetings, you could wear that banner. And if you had all these, like, wearing medals. And the wearing medals and wearing badges and having a uniform was part of scouting. But you had to be careful. I felt you had to be careful about that. I didn't think that was all that important, especially, you know, there was special knickers that you had to buy, and a lot of money, commercial interests were in selling Boy Scout uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, Boy Scouts are open to people of all economic ages then, at least in New England. There was some... In the South, there was racial discrimination, and they had black troops and white troops, and different churches, of course, that supported those kind of people.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in New England at that time, before the Civil Rights Movement, we had one black guy who was, we knew him because he was in, by that time I was in high school, I think, so we had a broader area that was covered, and he was, we never thought of him the racial issue. We thought of him as a fun guy, a nice guy, everybody liked. And we just didn't understand racial discrimination. Although we saw blacks sometimes in the, they grew tobacco in the Connecticut River Valley near where I lived. They grew two kinds of tobacco, some that was grown out outside, exposed, and mm-hmm. others are grown in a thin, sort of like a cheesecloth tent, which was called shade grown, where they could control the humidity inside and let the humidity get higher and then open up the sides if it got too hot so the plants would wilt. But the idea was to get the plants to grow fast and produce the leaves. The leaves were harvested separately and they were wrappers for cigars. Whereas the grown out side in the open, there were sort of coarser leaves, and you cut the whole plant at one time and hung them up to dry in the sheds, whereas the others had to be, women had to sew the leaves on in pairs in the sheds, and once they were dried, they took them all down. Stacking them up was a big operation in the sheds, open with timbers, and then they took them all down, and the women would be in tables there, and they would sort and ultimately strip the veins out of the center of the leaves, and then they do this when the leaves were almost dry but flexible. So they wanted to be flexible so they wouldn't crack and break up. And then they would put these together and then they'd end up with bundles of tobacco that could be shipped off to places that made cigars. In fact, we shipped a lot to Cuba because they were known to be the best cigar makers at the time.
Yeah.
And
I didn't know that tobacco grew in the Connecticut River Valley. Yeah. I think of tobacco as from the South.
I know. But this is high quality, really highest quality stuff. And the shade grown made that you can control the temperature and humidity and get optimal growth. Mm-hmm. And although there weren't a lot of insects that attacked tobacco, but there are a few. And they would keep insects out. But it was mainly for work. And it was harder in some ways working in the shade grown because you worked on your, if you were picking, you sit on your butt and dragged yourself along and picked one leaf from each side, row on one end, put them together, and you laid them in a basket, laid them between the plants, and you could stack those pairs up between the plants as you went along the row. And then someone would drag a canvas basket, like a basket, a shape like a square rectangular basket about so high, and you would put the one that was carrying those would have a handle, and you could get the loop. There were two handles mm-hmm. on either end. You could hook one of those handles and walk along there, and you had to bend over and load the basket very carefully with these leaves that hadn't wilted. Mm-hmm. So you had to stack them carefully, and then they would, when it filled up, you put this canvas over the top, you dragged it out into the open and just unhooked it and came back. And in the meantime, someone would come by in the early days with a horse and wagon, later with a tractor pulling the wagons, and these would be stacked on the wagon, and then they would go as much as a mile to these tobacco sheds where they would take them into the sheds. And then there were workers in there that would, women that were in there. And then they sewed, take these two leaves out that were paired together, and they would have a coarse needle and that they could thread, very easily threaded with string, and said it was string, and sewed these, put one end, they'd hook around a lath, like they used old days to put on the wall, and then they plaster over them. They were called laths, and they were about...
like 5 feet, 4 feet?
A little less than 4 feet, I think. And then there was a saw niche in either end. So you, the women would have a stands that they could put this on while they were doing this, and they would hook a string around one end and sew these leaves on it, and then spaced out in a special way. So the same pairs, number of pairs of leaves for every one of these laths. Then they would take that and put it on another deal. So it wasn't too heavy, but it was, you know, it was heavy enough. You had to be careful. Set it there, and then there were guys that were, then would move that up into the top and fill this whole barn.
Oh, for smoking.
On, pardon?
For like drying it.
For drying.
It's kind of like a smokehouse.
Yeah, except it was mainly, they, and then once they get it filled, then they would, there was someone that came and made sure the temperature stayed right. And you wanted this to happen in late summer when it was pretty warm, but you had about every other board up, was on a hinge on the outside of the barn, and you could open, they could open them up to allow more air in if it was getting too hot. You don't want it to get too hot, then it would sort of like cook.
Right.
And then if it getting cold, too cold and frost at night, they would have to build little, it was dirt floor. They'd take a pan, like a wash basin sized metal pan, put some charcoal in and started burning, and it would just charcoal. And they'd space those out to put enough heat in that the things wouldn't freeze while they're driving. And then usually it was just at night. And when it was dried, again, they had people to take them down. And then the women took them back off this last and stripped the mid-vein out of the leaves. And the leaves were still flexible but almost dry. And some of the flexibility was oils and wet along with a little bit of moisture, but not much, so that they would no longer, you could pack them together and they were dry enough so you wouldn't get decomposition and mold inside. And they were shipped that way in bundles of these together, big bundles, and shipped to where they were made into cigars.
And now, were most of the people working there African Americans?
No. They were mostly local peoples at first, and there were a lot of, in that community where I, these were mostly Polish people who had come over, and some of them were farmers, and some of them were, they were immigrants living in poor housing than other, but not too poor, because other people weren't too well off, and there weren't that many jobs, and some the other higher-paying jobs might go to non... It was the Polish women who did a lot of this work, and it was a good way for women to work and together, and they'd work well together because it was like a lot of conversation.
Yeah.
And they did... they worked well. In the fields, it was like any young people under supervision of older people, in the open grown, and as well as in the shade grown, you had to, young people or people had to be hired to go through when the tobacco was growing before you were going to pick the leaves. You want the emphasis for the plant to go in the leaves.
Not the flower.
Whereas the plant was trying to flower and produce seeds. So you had to top these top deals, preferably when they're young, and so they would snap off. Because they didn't snap off, you couldn't do it with your fingers, your hands. It was too tough. So you had the timing of that was crucial. and to get in there before it started getting tough. And then there were suckers that came out. If you took the tops off and shoot these suckers come out between the leaf and the stem, you wanted to stop those because you wanted everything to go into the leaves.
Right.
And that, if you work there, you snapped it off between your index and mid-finger and held it in with your thumb, and you, yeah, there was a trick to do it right. You had to do it quickly, and once you did it and learned how to do it without it not breaking properly, and then you tried to work it around and get it off, and you had to be fast, or you did it as a team. You're working down the fields, and if someone just left behind, it was because they weren't doing it right. And so somebody would say, you got to speed up if you're going to work here. And so you work for not a full day. That was in high school, and it was the best paying work while you're still a student in the summertime. And it wasn't very good pay, but at least you got paid by the hour. And if you put in the hours and in hot weather, it wasn't the greatest too. And then you had to come home and you had this smell of nicotine all over your fingers, and it couldn't wash it off initially. The stain would be there for quite a while, like 2 or 3 weeks after you got stopped working in the fields. But it was outdoor work, and you worked hard and you worked as a team. So you weren't by yourself. You worked with other people, and so you could have some joviality and connection with other people as long as you continue to do things fairly rapidly.
So you did this work when you were in high school?
Yeah.
It was a summer job?
Right.
That's why you know so much about it.
It is, but I was, and if you had to be proactive in lining up those jobs because they were the, if you're in a rural community, there weren't many jobs. And, you know, the only other things I could do to make money is, you know, if there were neighbors that wanted shoveled your driveways in the winter, but that was during school. And, I had a paper route that when I had a bicycle, then I could do a paper route, which you didn't make much money that way.
No.
And you did that after school, but it was some money. And the income from my father was needed so badly just to feed us and pay for the house and the heating and all of that. And so it was understood. We had an allowance, but the allowance was very, very minimal.
Yeah.
And So when you get your own money, then of course you could decide on how you wanted to spend that. And whereas your parents were still paying for your clothes and everything else, and plus it was, you know, what would you do if you weren't didn't have that first spare time in the summertime?
Yeah,
and. So it was good to learn the work ethic, and it led to, my neighbor, a guy who was a close friend in school, we were close buddies, and his uncle, I think it was, had a supervisory position in this tobacco company that grew the shade grown. And so he was able to work out a deal. Well, we had bought an old car, and it cost us $25. It was one of these old 1924, I think it was, touring car, you know, that had a canvas top, and that had long since gone. So it was like wide open there in terms of the weather. And it was This was during the beginning of the Second World War, and so that you couldn't get by. We didn't have any money to speak of, so we'd get old junk tires, and then you'd get
couldn't buy gas.
Couldn't buy gas, but we could usually scrounge a little bit of gas to get started, but the lack of gas was critical. But we wanted to be able to get enough to get this thing going. And then once we did get it going, we got he got a job through his uncle where he and I would spray paint some of these tobacco sheds, these big barns. So we had, they provided the ladders, they provided the compressor and the spray equipment with rig long hoses, because you had to go way up on these rig long ladders. These are tall barns. And then the spray, the compressor and what was on a little cart, a metal cart with smaller wheels, but we could tow that with our old car. So they gave us enough gas to do this, including gas that we'd use to have to use to clean out those at the end of the day, and clean out everything so that it wouldn't they wouldn't get stuck up with paint. Clean, flush out all the paint, and that was where we were. We were trying to be super careful with using gas, and maybe have a little extra that we could use. And then it just broke our heart to have all of this paint-filled gas that we use to wash things out. And like we'd have at least a couple of gallons of that. And so then we thought, well, let's strain it through cheesecloth and then try burning it. And that wasn't a good deal because we couldn't get it out.
And a lot of water in that gas.
It stuffed up the fuel lines on the car and the carburetor and everything. We had to go through and take everything out and clean it out again and decide we don't do that. But then we did other things occasionally. Once you got it going on the level, to get it going, you had to, it had a 12-volt bolt system, whereas most of the cars that were being made then were 6-volt. And so we couldn't afford to buy 12-volt batteries. I mean, that would have been, they were very expensive then, and not very many of them were being made. And so we realized you could use a 6-volt, but you wouldn't run the starter. It wasn't strong enough. So then you had to crank it, and it was a fairly heavy engine. That's had to be really careful about cranking cars. If it backfired, you held it in such a way that it, when it backfired, it wouldn't break your thumb. And so we learned all these tricks. But sometimes we didn't have enough gas, and we wanted to go someplace. So if you didn't have any hills to go over, you could use kerosene.
Oh.
And it's sort of like as close to diesel.
Mm-hmm.
And once it was going, you know, it would continue to go on diesel or kerosene, but it wouldn't have much power compared to gasoline. I remember one time there was this weekend a trip out to a lake, but to get there we had to go over this hill on a good highway for the area, a good highway, paved highway out of Manchester to, and it was, I think, Coventry Lake, where one or more students had, families had a cabin on the lake. So we, this guy is like, four or five of us in this one car, which we all chipped in what we could, but we couldn't buy enough gas, so we mixed some kerosene in with the gas. And we took off, and we got this one hill, and we got a good start, but then gradually we could see, are we going to make it or not, over the top, because it wasn't putting as much power. And then the cars were starting to back up behind us. It was probably, during when in the evening when people were coming home from working in shops and where. And so when we got almost to the top and it was starting to level off, my buddy who had instigated all this, he was driving it, and he said, "You guys got to get out and push, or we're not going to make it." So it was still running, but it needed an extra help. So we're all out pushing this thing, and there's this car behind us. And for worse, they were pissed off because we were holding up. But then it was so funny for them to see us all out there. And we finally made it over the top, and then we're home free, going downhill from there. And so we had a great time. And we had one accident, though. We were going downhill on this little wood road going down to the lake, and it was kind of gravelly and going a little too fast, and we couldn't stop. It wasn't very, brakes weren't very good anyway, and then on gravel, they just kind of, wheels are liable to slide in different directions. And so we went off the road and hit a tree, a small tree, about 6 inches in diameter, by one of the fenders, and the car stopped. And we were so impressed by how tough they used to make these cars. There's a slight dent in this thin black, fender, that because it was so thick and tough, and we were able to push it back onto the road and continue along. And so at any rate, we had a lot of fun with that whole vehicle, and they were getting astray, but I think this is important. And that was, we occasionally would drive that to school if we had, the weather was good, and if in the springtime, if it was beautiful weather, that was nice. And so we drive it to school, and it was such a unique old antique but it was also a junker and right. considered. And we parked that out, and other kids, got a big kick out of it. But then there were a lot of course, prankish kids, us included, and we had been involved in some pranks. So one time they were making these kind of firecrackers you could hitch onto the spark plugs, and you take the wire off a spark plug and you hook it onto it, and then hook the other wire onto where the spark plug was. And you just do it onto the spark plug. That's right. You take the wire off, and that triggered the thing to explode.
When you started it,
when you tried to start it, right. it would explode, and it was a mild explosion, but with a lot of smoke coming out of it and steam, like kabang, and then the stuff would come out. So I remember when we came out and jumped in the car, there was nobody around, and thought that was strange. And they were all hidden and watching from a distance in shrubbery and what. what was his name? I'll remember his name in a minute. He flipped the key and kaboom. And so he just, leaped over the side and ran like heck. Right. We thought the whole thing was going to go up. And then they had all this laughing. So they had one on us then.
They got you back.
Probably, or started another round. But yeah.
Well, so back to the Boy Scout theme.
Oh, yeah.
Of, how that affected the rest of your life.
The crucial part of that is that, I thought Boy Scouts was the greatest, but I wanted to I was still I was in high school, and I lived remotely. So to get there, I had to take commercial buses, two commercial buses, and they didn't, it's a different one to the one town, and then another one make connections there. And I couldn't stay and try out for, I couldn't do any athletics, team sports and stuff, because then I would have no way home.
Now that was with Boy Scouts, or that was with the high school?
That was the high school.
Right.
However, the relationship to Boy Scouts was, I had like more than enough merit badges to be an Eagle Scout, but I hadn't done the athletics one. Mm-hmm. So I had to, there were only two advisors for athletics, and they were coaches for the cross country coach as well as the hockey swimming coach. And they were both advisors for that. And their plan, if you wanted to get your merit badge, you had to try out for their team and practice and get, say, on the team and get involved in meets, etc., which meant you had to stay after school for the training and practicing and then find your way home. Well, we family had this one car, and they didn't have the money anyway or the gas to come and pick the kids up after school. It was like about a round trip, 6 or 7 miles, and from where I lived. And so if I had, if the weather was good, I might be able to do it with my bike, but this would violate the family plan of having dinner together.
Right.
And I would have gone with that, but it wasn't realistic if you, to because I would get back much too late. I wouldn't leave 9 o'clock or so,
right,
before I'd get back, and had still had homework to do and have dinner. And so the attitude was, well, these coaches said, well, that's the only way we can do it is that way. They didn't have the time to take you on as a special person and be a tutor or something. Mm-hmm. And so I was frustrated because I couldn't get this done, and that was the only thing that was holding up being an Eagle Scout. So then I went, and I graduated from high school. I was going to be drafted. I enlisted in the Navy and served in the military. Well, military service, I began to reflect back on Boy Scouts, and I realized Boy Scouts, I was not big on military service, but I was glad to be able to serve my country during that war, the Second World War, when there was no question, but there was a real threat to societies because of the Nazis and their tremendous impact starting in Europe, and that the United States had to get into the war. And my father, who was somewhat of a pacifist, definitely a pacifist, but he, because his had a family background in Europe, in Switzerland and France, and my mother in Europe, in England, that, yeah, I mean, it was obvious that we couldn't abandon that Europe that was trying to hold off the Nazis taking over literally the world.
Right.
And so, and then, of course, then the Japanese joined them as well.
So do you think the Boy Scouts prepared you for being in the military?
Yeah, Boy Scouts were started by Lord Baden-Powell, who was, he lived in Rhodesia in Southern Africa and was, you know, made money from investing in the mines or what. But his idea was that this is good training for young people for the military.
Mm-hmm.
In colonial countries as well as in other countries, which was you could say that, yeah, that's probably true. But the emphasis was on military training, which there was some logic to that. But on the other hand, being training to defend yourself and live in the bush could be valuable, especially, but that wasn't the way the British liked to fight.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and of course, that's that in a military war, and certainly in Africa, if they got in a war there, which they did, that was preparation for the military. And of course, this is true in the Soviet Union. They had young communist groups that they did a lot of camping out, and sort of mirrored,
right,
mirrored the Boy Scouts, and so did the Nazis.
Right.
The Nazi youth, big emphasis on and on being a good soldier, being a good soldier as well, and that means taking the discipline, military discipline, and, you know, learning how to use tools and stuff, and even firearms safely, et cetera. So I began to feel that there must be some other way. Plus, then I realized that Boy Scouts were discriminated in the U.S. in the South, that blacks, where we'd had blacks in New England, in the Boy Scouts and in schools, and we didn't, not a lot of them, a few of them, but there was no pronounced racism. If there was any ethnic animosity, it was usually toward the recent European immigrants. I mean, like, the Italians were looked down upon because mm-hmm. they were more recent, yet gradually we realized, well, Italian food is wonderful. They produced great restaurants, and mm-hmm. and they were good people once. And so they tended to be tough guys sometimes with knives, and then earlier lived in Hartford for a short time, right in the city when we first moved down. There were a neighborhood which was mainly French Canadian, and the kids were going to parochial schools, and we were going to public schools. We had to walk through that neighborhood, my brother and I, and there were little gangs of, you know, third and fourth grade and fifth grade kids that were hanging out after school on the sidewalks, you know, adjacent to the street. There was no playgrounds right in that area, and we'd had to go through there. And here we were, we were like aliens in a foreign community. And it was a good experience in the long run, but we got into a few fights when we learned to run fast and know when to run. And I even got lost right after we moved there because we'd only been there for a week or so, and my brother had made a chum friend. And he brought him home, and he suggested we go to a museum that was about probably 10 blocks away through a park and totally strange neighborhood. So the three of us went, and this guy knew the way. We went, and the parents agreed to all this because he was a nice guy, and they had a good relationship with my brother. I was a couple of years younger than mm-hmm. them, and so I was a younger brother, but they would look after me, you know. So we went to the museum, got there okay, and it was, you know, in a home, and it was... You know, they had some stuffed animals, and it was nice to be able to do that. In those days, they weren't much on museums then, mm-hmm. and especially for just kids and
right.
So we started back and going through one of these parks, which had trails going in different directions, that we got confronted with a gang of kids. And so we had to run like hell. I got left behind.
Oh, yeah.
And so they came back and looked for me, and they couldn't find me. So they went home, and I was trying to find them, of course. And that was, I don't know, these kids who were just passing through that created the problem, probably like us. But finally went back to the closest place I could remember, but it was where there were shops. And, you know, I thought, well, I'll go and get some help from a policeman, I thought. But then I realized I didn't even know my address. And we were just moved in there, so my name didn't have any meaning. I didn't know my address, or there was no phone number or anything like that. And so I was embarrassed to stop and ask a policeman, you know, where I was, because that, you know, where I was there.
You're right here.
And so I was beginning to feel real bad, because I realized I was in an awkward situation, and it was getting late in the evening, you know, and just starting to get a little dark. And I thought, oh man, you know, what do I do? You know, well, I should have gone in and the store and say, I'm lost, and they at least would have tried to find. It was a awkward situation, and I was out on the street, and you know, I'm breaking down and crying wouldn't have done any good. And this is it's the end of the world for me.
Well, you were what?
I was about
eight.
Pardon?
You were about how old? 8 years old? 9 years old?
About eight, six, seven. Yeah, eight. Yep. Or seven and a half. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, just about when I probably would have started crying, and maybe a policeman or somebody would have taken some action, but I looked up there, and oh, this is my father coming. He is out doing a search, and so, oh man, that was nirvana. So at any rate, back to the Boy Scouts, I mean, by the time I got out of the Navy and gone through all the military training and basic training and all of that, I thought, and then the reason I got out of the Navy, because the war was over.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, I don't think I want to be in the military. I had a chance to stay in because I was in a flight training program.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to stay in for 6 years after you completed the training and got your commission. And, you know, it would have been perhaps a good thing to do, but I didn't like military service.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed some of the times because of the guys I were with, you know, you bonded with young people your age, and they were in the same boat you were. And they were nice guys because they were kind of from similar backgrounds. But I wasn't doing too well as a student, because we were taking courses and heavy emphasis on things like trigonometry and math. And those were not my strong suits in high school. And I suffered for not doing very well in high school. But I was squeaking along and probably would have gotten through okay. But then the war is over, and we either had to make a decision to go into the regular Navy, in which case, until you got discharged. And then, so that meant another 6 months, because priority for discharge was on people that were in the war. And so we worked at Naval Training Station and took basic training there in north of Chicago, the Great Lakes Navy Training Station. And that was, you know, guard duty, KP duty, and what have you. And so when I got out, I realized that, you know, I didn't, I was pretty much decided I was a pacifist and didn't want to get involved in wars in the future. Of course, a lot of people that fought in the war came to the same conclusion of the Second World War, that they wouldn't have to go again, and many of them didn't have to go again. But I had this, I could have then perhaps gone to, and, but the, then there was this different situation when you come back from the war. Main thing was on getting a job, and I wanted woods work, and I found it, and that was great, and that was, having been in Boy Scouts helped me, but also I had, the reason I got into Boy Scouts was because I liked that kind of thing.
Now, did you quit the Boy Scouts, or you stayed through it till you graduated from high school?
Well, you don't really quit the Boy Scouts. I mean, you probably were some dues, but they were minor. And you were sort of, you didn't lose ground if you stopped. You could come back in again. And so then the way it, I sort of decided, do I really want to go through this and just to get an Eagle Scout to prove that I could do it?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there was something that said I'd want to do that. But on the other hand, I didn't really like the idea of it. I didn't like the idea that by that time there were different, there was starting a movement that girls, you know, said, why couldn't they join the Boy Scouts instead of the Girl Scouts? And well, that created a problem with the Boy Scouts. And then there was this discrimination in the South. And so I decided, no, I don't really want to be an active Boy Scout. But then when I was drafted into the Army here in Alaska in the Korean War, and I was based at Ladd Field, which is what Fort Wainwright, mm-hmm. In the 4th Infantry, and I volunteered to be in a Scouts platoon because it was, they were going to stay in, I knew they were, we were going to stay in Alaska for one thing, but we did all kinds of nice trips. We had all, we had a dog kennel with two dog teams, and we did dog trips and dog sled trips, and we did riverboat trips and what. And then there was a Boy Scout camp at Lost Lake near Quartz Lake, mm-hmm. that they were looking for an advisor and also a badge examiner, and they knew my background, and they asked if I'd be willing to, and that was the, I would advise on camping and woods work or something like that. And you had your time off, and I still believed in the value of Boy Scouts for young people and young guys. And so they, if you went there, it was like a furlough, and you lived there for maybe a week or 2 weeks at the most. And I took kids out and did nature interpretation for them, hikes, and was an examiner for a couple of merit badges. But at that point, I had given up on the Eagle Scout, and it would sort of violate my principal said that at that time of that, well, I'm not that supportive of Boy Scouts. I do this because I want the kids to learn.
So you weren't supportive of Boy Scouts because of the discrimination?
And military.
And the military type atmosphere?
Yeah. Yeah, that was largely it. Mm-hmm. And it was the more important aspect of it was a military type training to be soldiers. And mm-hmm. when you train people to be soldiers, then you expect that they will be soldiers yeah. at some stage.
Right.
And so you don't try to resolve issues except with the war.
But so the time you spent in the Boy Scouts, though, in the outdoors and learning about plants and animals and survival, you think that developed your interest further? I mean, you obviously did it a little bit.
Yeah, definitely.
Kid,
but... Yeah, definitely. And I felt, and I got some training there because to be group leaders and Cub Scouts the same way. Mm-hmm. And then when I went into I was drafted into the Army, and I went to basic training at Fort Richardson out of Anchorage, they immediately, I had a master's degree then, and all of these other guys were, high school was as far as they
went. Barely out, and probably barely out.
And so they kind of looked at me like, they called me Doc.
Yeah.
And, but they respected me enough, and the whoever was in charge there decided I should be a platoon leader.
Right.
So I was, and probably some Boy Scout experience was part of that, mm-hmm. but it was education too and more experience I had and when I was since.
And so did the Boy Scouts influence your environmental philosophy?
Well, I have to look back, you know, over this, what happened in between Boy Scouts and when I got into environmental philosophy. Yeah, everything that went on in my life had some influence on it. And you might say it influenced my philosophy, period. My interest in philosophy, let's put it that way.
Right.
And so the environmental aspect of it, environmental philosophy sort of implies that I was an environmentalist. In a sense, I was, and that aspect of environmental philosophy was related to that, but not a militant or politically active environmentalist.
But that sort of changed through time.
Well, not too much.
I mean, you at some point you have been an active conservationist.
You know, I have
you,
been.
You helped with the Northern Sand.
It all depends on you figure active, because I was when I was wildlife unit leader, there was sort of a policy there that came out of Washington that you shouldn't take up the leadership positions in those
right.
organizations. Which seemed reasonable to me, and I thought I don't want to be identified, because I was trained as a scientist,
right.
an environmental scientist, and they were it's important we needed that, and I didn't want to be, and I believed that I didn't want to be branded as an environmental right. activist.
But did you?
But I was I belonged to Northern Alaska Environmental Center, and I did serve on the board when I was wildlife unit leader. But I was on the board. I wasn't whatever they called.
You weren't the director.
Director. I wasn't the director.
No. You weren't the president of the board. But did you help found the Alaska Conservation Society with Ginny and Celia and Fred Dean?
I wouldn't say I helped found. I was supportive of their efforts when I was here, but that was when I was a grad student and a short period before I got drafted into the military. And at that short period, I wasn't around much. I was in the field working as a field technician. And so I was, yeah, if I was around, I went to meetings and was quite supportive. And it was, you could say it was a development stage of the, but I wasn't based here. Oh, and then when I took the job in Southeast, I was out of touch. And that's right. When that was still in the formative stages of the Alaska Conservation Society, where people like Bob Whedon, who took a job with Fish and Game later, a couple of years later than I did, after we became a state, I was in Southeast, and I still had some connections up here.
Right.
And especially when I worked for Fish and Game after I had completed the PhD requirements, or most of them, and get up there because my job required that, and interact with other people in the cooperative unit.
Right.
And then I frequently was, if I was up here, I might, if I was up here on a weekend or something, and there was a nature, Conservation Society meeting, I would definitely be involved.
Yeah, I somehow thought you had a role in the early days of the organization. I've seen your name associated with it or something. Did you write for the newsletter or work on issues for them? Or provide them information?
No, there was a close... I got to know them a bit because we, while I was a student, we did... we had one trip down to Denali when that first Institute of Arctic Biology... it was the Arctic Institute... annual meeting, first one. But,
not the Wilderness Society.
No.
The Arctic Institute?
Yeah, which was the Alaska division of the Arctic Institute. And the meeting was held in Denali.
Was it at Camp Denali, you mean?
No, it was held at the park headquarters in the hotel. And that's when there was this Bob Rausch, the
scientist,
he was there, and we were there as students. But there was this debate about Bob Rausch had worked up at Anaktuvuk Pass. Right. There was this debate about wolf killing from the air. And they learned that you could shoot wolves from the air. And that was the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a division of predator and rodent control, which was within the Fish and Wildlife Service, or maybe they called it Biological Survey or something like that.
At the time, it may not have been.
And so and that's when Jay Hammond was a pilot working for them, and they did these, several airplanes would go up there, and they were in the North Slope where you could track and shoot wolves from the air on the North Slope in the wintertime and make a big kill. So they ended up killing a couple hundred wolves. And the whole idea was not ecologically sound, but it wasn't. But the Fish and Wildlife Service, you know, they were criticized because, you know, why did you go up there and kill these wolves when the caribou aren't being hunted significantly? And it was, yes, but if we allow them to... increase the caribou bigger. At that time, the idea was that that's how new herds got started, that they would fracture off and make new herds. And so it was the Western Arctic herd, which was getting large and migrating through the Anaktuvuk Pass as well. And another reason, and Bob Rausch's, one of his points is that the native people hunted the wolves, and that was part of their culture too. And of course, earlier on in the territorial, that was their source of income because they bonded they got a $25 bounty or something like that for each wolf killed. Mm. And they could sell the wolf skins, and they use them to make things, especially parkas, and they like wolves for that.
Right.
And then they eventually started making these masks out of caribou skin. But
so your involvement with Alaska Conservation Society was your scientific data, that, like on the caribou herd, or other things you were observing, and then they took that information.
Alaska Conservation Society was more involved in things at that time, like the proposed Rampart Dam.
Right. Well, they opposed the wolf bounty and, you know, the pipeline issue.
Well, and when I was with the Department of Fish and Game, and after statehood came, the Department of Fish and Game had to be careful, but we also lobbied the legislature to get rid of the bounties, because we believed, these young biologists there all believed that it was just a welfare program for Bush peoples primarily, but not just Bush people, and that it wasn't, the predator and rodent control went where they could kill more wolves and show a good record, where they're in the rainforest areas, there were some areas they could kill wolves, but they couldn't kill them in big, large numbers like they could on North Slope.
Right.
And then they were using all these other kind of poisons. We also were strong in lobbying right from the minute we became a state to get rid of poisons.
Yeah.
Because that was legal to use them for trapping in, up until about that time.
Yeah, it caused all kinds of other problems.
Yeah.
Well, the reason I was asking about the Conservation Society is Ginny would talk about, you know, there were people who supported the organization, but they couldn't participate because of their jobs. Bob Whedon and Fred Dean, you know, and that those people might have scientific information that was useful to the cause, so they would feed Ginny and Celia the information.
Well, I was in that boat.
And you were in that boat.
Yeah.
That was your roles.
It was more later after I became unit leader.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, definitely that I prided myself in that I had good contacts and I could pass on information.
Right.
And
but you couldn't be on the board, you couldn't be visible in the organization.
Right.
But you didn't help get the organization started, but your role was later.
Mm-hmm.
And did you write things for their newsletter too?
I don't recall that. Yeah, I did write one or two, I think. One on, I think that was them I wrote for about muskoxen on Nunavak Island. Mm-hmm. And I did it. That might have been the Hickel administration, the first one.
Oh, right.
And sort of making fun of, wrote it, you know, with tongue-in-cheek about muskoxen and as being, you know, farm animals or something like that. That Wally Hickel was all in favor of John Teal's effort to domesticate the muskoxen. But Teal didn't want them to be shot, and so Hickel went along with that and said, no, they shouldn't be shot.
Well, it's sort of the boreal weed concept of environmental understanding. But yeah, well, it still sounds to me though you supported the conservation efforts.
Yeah, and I
and you believe in that. You're philosophically you believe in protecting animals and wild places and habitat and things like that.
Yeah, and I had connections with Ginny and Celia and their connections, including the meters up at Wild Lake, and so. Then when I came here and as a wildlife unit leader, then that was when there were potlucks that I was always, and my wife and
I. Yeah, so you knew them socially.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, I mean, makes sense. I mean, you both skied, and you worked with Fred Dean, who lived next door to them.
And I went to their meetings, too.
And you went to the meetings, yeah.
Yeah.
So you were all part of the same circles.
Right.
But you were a little more behind the scenes in terms of the activism.
Right.
Okay.
But I had students working in Denali too that were connected with the Camp Denali.
Uh-huh.
That were close friends of Ted LaShelt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know the name.
And others.
He was one of your students, his Wolverine work? Didn't he study Wolverine?
No, that was before I was unit leader. He was a fellow student I knew well. And Les Ferrick, another one.
Right.
Had done a lot of work there in the park, and I continued to work closely with Les here.
Right. So what was I going to ask? I was going to ask you something about, so philosophically, your perspective, protecting wild places and habitat and all that comes from where?
What's the question again?
You seem to believe in protecting wild places and animals and habitat and all that. So where do you think that comes from?
Well, from my whole life, but in my experience in New England, where, New England was about in colonial times, it was about 25% forested. And then by the time I was growing up there, it was 75% forested because the early farmers that cleared the land and built the stone walls and took the stones out of the fields, they went west because land was much more productive. And they were subsistence farms that were not competitive in the long run. And so that was a start because I knew the history and some of the state forests that I worked in. Yeah, there were, if you went one area, there was an old plant that cut the trees and creosoted them for telephone poles.
Oh.
And that was shut down and hadn't been cleaned up properly, but it was shut down. And the state forest grew up around there. It was a beautiful forest. And
a forest of creosote trees? No.
No. No, these were trenches with the creosote in them. But, I began to appreciate more that, getting that job, for example, in the state forest, and when I came back from the Navy, and then some of my two or three of my close buddies, one of them was so young he didn't get into the Second World War, and he had already working for, he got an engineering degree, so he was ahead of us. He was younger.
But he'd gone to college while you were in the military.
So he had a good job and working up rapidly in the military manufacturing of aircraft engines. And then, which was close to that part of Connecticut where we grew up. And then a couple others were guys who figured, well, we did our service, which they hadn't, like me, they hadn't seen any battle. So let's take it easy, because there was like servicemen's work compensation. They paid you some money, and we were used to not much money.
Right.
So here's, you get this free money, and you could milk the system for close to a year that way. And one of them said, yeah, that's my plan. I said, well, what are you going to do after that? I don't know, but I'd probably go to the university or something. And he did, and became an accountant and worked for the insurance companies. But I thought, it's a kind of welfare. I don't...
No.
Why not get a job? I mean... I wasn't just after money. In fact, money wasn't a big deal. You got to have it at
some point
to get by. And the main thing was so you could get a car and get a job of some kind. But so we had this one woman who was a school teacher at the school, elementary school, that roomed with us. She taught 5th and 6th grades, but I went to 7th and 8th grades here. But she taught, and so she roomed with us and board. And she was a very nice woman and took a liking to me. And as we, you know, ate breakfast together and sometimes other meals. and she knew... My teacher was an older, more senior woman, and she was a good teacher. I liked her, but she was disappointed in me because she sent notes home that I wasn't performing up to my
potential.
And at any rate, this other woman's name was Betty Willard, and she was not married.
She's the one who lived with you.
She lived with us, yeah. And she was... She was a very good person for me to get to know, because she liked me, and she would sometimes, you know, when I was there and people had other things on the weekend and something, she'd talk to me about, you know, try to find out what my interests were, and she knew that I was searching, like, so she wasn't trained to be a counselor, but she wanted me to do what I really wanted to be, but she knew it was going to be nature-oriented, if it was even agriculture, because I like agriculture. But then I was, by that stage, when I got out of the Navy, I was realizing that well, something else. I was still a bit interested in agriculture, but what about forestry? And that's when she, and I was looking for work when I got out of the Navy, and she said, well, I have some, she knew somebody in a town nearby that was a, that knew the forester at this state forest, Neshaminet State Forest, who had, you know, he was a fairly young guy with university training, and he knew that they had a, you know, woods crew that worked, and it might be a I mean, like there were not many jobs because there are other veterans coming back too. And some of them were more senior. And so, and this was fall when there weren't many jobs, outdoor jobs, but they worked all winter long. And so she said, well, you should go down there and talk to that forester. And maybe we can get the person she knew to contact the forester and say that I would be coming down and that I'd be a good woodworker or something like that. So I went down and talked to him, and it was a nice, likable young guy, red-haired. And so he interviewed me, and so I was a bit young for the woodworking crew, but and I didn't know, I didn't have the skills, but I had the capable. I was capable.
Right.
And they were very, a lot of it was handwork.
Yeah, you've talked about that before, that job, and it was hard work.
Well, it was hard work, but it was based upon your learning to use an axe properly. And he insisted that you, if you get the job, you had to buy your own axe, and you have to put a handle on it yourself, and you have to learn how to sharpen it properly, et cetera, et cetera, and how to use it. So it's a fairly heavy axe, and it's Western logging was from the Midwest. West was all double-bitted axe, so you had two sharpened blades. The Eastern attitude was, no, you get a better heft with the single-headed, but you have to keep it sharp and be very careful with it. And you always carried a stone in your pocket, a sharpening stone.
Right.
And then you could, back at the headquarters, you had a wheel and water, and you could pump this wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And you
had to sharpen it.
And you had to, when you bought this head at a certain hardware store, and near that forest that carried it, and the head it wasn't ground down properly to be right. So you had to learn how to ground it down, and we had the other guys help me, especially there was one bachelor guy in his 40s that had worked there for many years, and he was sort of a senior guy, a nice guy, and he was good at training and explaining things and showed you how to do it. And
mm-hmm.
And it was, you had to be persistent, and you had to have advice because you didn't know how to grind it.
Well, as you say, it's an art and a skill.
Exactly. And then once you got to use it, then you started developing the skills, and you realized, yeah, it is convenient size and works well for the type of woods we were working in. And then the other thing was a sweet saw, which you learned to use, a big sweet saw that...
That's one of those two-man saws.
No, this is the same kind we have now that you can buy them. They're very popular. And they have a thin blade.
Oh, like a big bow saw.
A bow saw,
okay.
Yeah. They were called sweet saws then. And
I thought a sweet saw was the one where you've got a guy on both ends.
No,
that's a whip saw. No?
These were hand saws.
Maybe I'm thinking of a whip saw. Anyway, a sweet saw is the bow kind.
Whip saw might be the one because of a big whip saw is a two-person saw. And if you don't want it to whip around, so you have to keep it. That's the job. Keep it going straight, and you never push. You just pull. So that's if you push, it screws it up, screws the cut up, and binds it.
Mm.
So I'd learned that from my working with my grandfather.
Your grandfather, yeah.
And I learned to use an axe, but it was usually a smaller axe because I was younger. But
well, as you say, it's, I mean, even from your early childhood, you were doing things outdoors, you know, on a farm setting or rural setting in the woods, with your grandfather and your brother. And so you just had an affinity for being an outdoors person and wanting to preserve that.
And learning the skills that go with it.
Right.
To do it efficiently rather than using a dull axe, for example, and learning how to fell the trees and making them go where you want them to go. And that's a bit of a challenge when they're growing fairly close together.
Yeah.
And so you don't want them to hang up. And when we're working, say, like three or four of us in one pine plantation, the red pine, and the average size of the larger ones were about this big.
Is that like 8 inches, 6 inches?
About so big.
I don't know.
And then they wanted them to be this big when they harvested them. And so we would thin, and that would you make cordwood piles. And that you had to be, you didn't want to measure them, but they essentially 4 foot. And so you had to use your axe, you know, and lay that down to get, know exactly the length of your axe and handle, and then you laid that on there about 2 times and to get 4 foot. And so then you stack them up. Well, you could be off an inch or two and not a big deal, but you had this nice, neat pile of cordwood that you put where you could get to it with a tractor and a wagon and from a wood road. And so then, but then when we're working like that, you were frequently working so just far enough apart so you couldn't see one another because you didn't want to be working where if a tree fell, it would hit you and or them. And but you could hear the other guys doing this. And then when one, I don't know whether, I don't think we yelled timber or anything because we didn't have to do that because we knew where. And then.
You probably didn't wear hard hats.
I don't think so, no. And so then we, you'd hear someone cuss like hell. You'd hear the crack as a tree was coming down, and then it wouldn't come crashing down. Then it would, you hear it when it hit the ground, you could hear it. The branches would break, and sort of like a loud mushing sound. And, and but if it got hung up, you know, you heard it cussing like hell. And then the worst case scenario was if you hung one up and you needed help. Because you maybe your saw would get binded, suck, because you had then, you know, it it would, might pinch the saw and you need another saw and another guy, or you may have to cut a small tree and use it as a lever.
Right.
And it might take 2 people to do this. Well, we could do that, and we did it, of course, but if you didn't want it to happen for you too many times in the day, and it slowed you down. So your pile doesn't get very big if you hung them up.
And did you get paid by how big your pile was?
No, I think we paid per day. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Well, as I say, you definitely had an affinity for the outdoors, so it's sort of not surprising that you became a scientist and environmentalist. Yeah.
But I also learned a lot, of course, about trees and what and growth and stuff there.
Right.
And but also learned to tackling a job, do it well. And so that's, I have problems with a lot of Alaskans, young men who are, you know, building new homes and what. They remain unfinished, and because And I was a bit of that way too, because you're going to finish it, you have to have the money. So the first part, you want to make it livable so you don't have to rent.
Right.
And you move your family in, and then you want it to be warm, and then you want it to have the basics, and the siding is not the basic.
No.
It comes later. The Tyvek is on there.
That stays for a long time.
This one across the street.
So what you just said, though, is important about you learned that, you know, you're going to do a job, you do it well, and you do it complete.
Yeah, and
that's an important thing to
This is the role model that farmers provide,
mm-hmm.
because a farmer can only be successful, and they have all these different kinds of jobs, and that's what fascinated me about farming. There's so many different jobs, and you're the guy. You're the guy, and you have to figure out how to do them.
Yeah, I mean,
and
you're right.
Try to do them efficiently.
You're the mechanic. You're the guy plowing the field. You're the one feeding the chickens and milking the cows and...
Yeah, and you have to figure out, do I do the plowing today or to do something else today? And you still have to milk the cows and what. And if you get start too early, know the soil is not too much moisture and it's muddied up and what.
Right.
Not workable. On the other hand, you got to try to time things and you've got to think about germination. I mean, it's very complex to be a good farmer.
Yeah, you're right.
And it's like, and to me, it's this whole question of complexity. It's coming out now. There's some publication on complexity.
Hmm.
And there's a tendency for environmental scientists for scientists in general, to try to reduce the complexity of understanding. And it's like there's a limit to what the human brain can handle in dealing with complexity. So that's why we go to modeling, computer modeling. If things are too complex, then we can't... What are the variables that affect how a tree grows or a moose reproduces successfully in a continual moose in a given area? What are the variables and how do you factor those in? And that you have to factor in, you know, the summer forage and winter forage, then you have to factor in previous history of moose populations and what effect have they already had on the forage? Was it positive in stimulating more regrowth or negative because it was too heavy? And how can that be corrected? And how does that relate to the snow depth in any given winter? And how does it relate to the present density of the moose and how does it relate to the survival and growth of the young moose?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the whole system fails in managing moose, for example, in Alaska, because if it's too complex, Board of Game and even the top administration and Fish and Game, we want a simple solution. It's like going to war is a simple solution because you don't want to deal with the complexity.
Well, also because sometimes it's so complex, there may be... isn't an answer. There isn't one way. There's, this affected that, and this is that way because of that other thing, and you can't do just one thing and solve it.
Yeah, but so you have to make decisions in wildlife management.
Mm-hmm.
You got to make decisions on an annual basis because you have to deal with the political aspects of wildlife management, which means hunting and use of the environment. And the making those decisions, you want to do it understanding as much as possible about the variables that influence it. And so, but there's a tendency to get focused in. And that's what bugged me just today at the seminar and last night when I gave comments on Park Service laws for the preserves, it was interesting because the Park Service thing, that was good because the Park Service had these preliminary open for comment. There were a lot of comments, although they kept everybody to about 3 minutes, and they're pretty strict about that. One or two people went over, but not too much. They just had to get it out. And once they get up there, these are these guys that, you know, they don't think about. I mean, if you have 3 minutes and everybody's there and, you know, there's 7 till 9 and there's a long sign-up sheet, and are they going to get through or not? And what happens to the people that don't get to? And there's some people that came later, and there's always people come later, and a few that get early just to be the first ones. I was impressed, but in the front row, I was sitting on the second row, and the guy, the Park Service guy, and then he had a woman, and they had a sheet and a paper with a big one. Mm-hmm. And that was, they had to explain that. That was when you're halfway through. I couldn't see her when she held that up. So I thought it was once 1 minute.
Right.
It was a little confusing. And then she held up a zero when you're finished.
Right.
And you should stop when that zero came up. And but she was watching her close and, you know, was very good about it. And the guy that would call off the name was, you know, he was very polite. He'd call the name and the person would come up. And there was no opportunity to ask questions.
Yeah.
They said, if we have time left over, people can come up that feel they hadn't said all they wanted, which was true of several of us, me included. Yeah. But she also pointed out you could have hand in the written comments, right, which I had a copy.
Yeah.
And I
I've done that where there was a hearing that I went to go testify and the waiting list was so long. I was going to have to sit there for like 2 hours before they got to me. And so I just went home and wrote up my comments and mailed them in.
Oh, yeah. Well, there were people that came and didn't stay because it was, you know, they got late and they were long down on the list. But they got through all of the lists about 10 minutes before 9, and then there were a few lay people that came in, and they were able to go ahead. But at any rate, it was in front of me. I was sitting next to a Houston game gal who was a former student, I forget her name, of us, and she's still working for Houston game. And then Mary Shields was there, and Fran Maher, and usual people. And then sitting in front of me was this row of guys, and they were like about 50 years old. I knew one of them Dick Bishop was on one end. Mm. And then on the other end was Norm Amstrup. He's a builder. He's the brother of Steve Amstrup.
I know Steve Amstrup's the polar bear biologist.
This is an older brother, a little older, not much. And he did some work on the house I built up on Cedar Ridge. Mm. A really good guy and a good builder. But I know it was art and honor because I wanted him to do more work up there. And he said, you know, I got to know him before a little bit. And he said, yeah, I'd like to do work there. But, you know, it's busy season. I got to know in advance. And then I finally was ready. I wanted to contact him. And he says, they were too busy. Unfortunately, he would have liked to have done it, but we could do staining. And I said, well, count on it. And because we're going to have that done. And, And but then I said, well, why couldn't you do this? He says, you're too busy. No, he says, that's the moose season. Oh, yeah, strict rules.
Yeah. He was too busy because
he took off for the, see, he was Arden Hunter. And I really liked him. And so he's sitting on one side. I didn't know how he was going to present his. And then the two guys in two or three in the middle, I couldn't believe it. They all were the same. I could tell they were hunters.
Right.
And they get up there and you didn't know what they were going to say, but they talked about the importance of hunting, and one of them was saying, generally there's a fairly good system here, and then, bingo, they came out totally negative toward bear baiting, which I said, it's totally inconsistent with hunting ethics. And they went on and on, not on, and they used their time well. And so here they, three of them were all, they, of course, mostly knew one another, but not real well. And Norm got up and he said he wasn't as strong about bear baiting. He agreed with the Park Service regulations up to a point, he said, but we don't like more regulations. And then there was, and Dick Bishop sort of was the same way, but he felt that there was not fair treatment of the rural people compared to the urban hunters. And that we should, you bear that in mind, particularly in these park preserves.
Right.
Which made sense. And then and some guy, this Compo came in late, and he was one of those that hadn't signed up initially. And when we went through the, finally went through the list, then they had a new list of about 8 or 10 people. And he came up there and it was like, well, I don't want any more regulations and we should be able to do our own thing. This is Alaska. I mean, it was like the state of Alaska owns park preserves? No. And so I made a point of emphasizing that this park preserves are preserves intending to, and well stated, to maintain natural systems, and that this is a limit to what you can do that without having major impact on systems. And I didn't get around to saying too much about bear baiting because that was in the later part I didn't have time to. And I wanted to talk about this book on bear and wolf management that I was involved with and point out that there were two recommendations that weren't being followed by Fish and Game that were all important, and that is that focus on habitat, and that you should understand the habitat, and that before any kind of control, predator control, that the habitat should be evaluated to determine what the status is, the carrying capacity for their target, for the prey species that you want to manage for, like moose. And then the second one that was a recommendation, which I thought was a good one, because so frequently we get this polarization between state and federal. And that is a recommendation from that panel for that book was that it was focused on Department of Fish and Game management, was that the Department of Fish and Game should work more closely with other state, federal, and private wildlife organizations management, or wild land management, I think that was it, which meant DNR, which meant DEC, which meant Native communities, which meant parks and refuges and forests, federal. And what they work together and collaboration in studying the habitat. Now, it was, in the early days, a lot of collaboration on the Kenai with the Kenai Refuge and the Department of Fish and Game, and a little of that continues now, not much, because the present administration, top administration, got so politicized, you know, we don't want to work with the federal government. We know what's best. And then they don't, nobody studies environment in state lands. And then Fish and Game wants to come in and manage on federal lands when they don't, haven't done any environmental studies themselves. And the park hasn't put a high priority in it. I think they're both at fault. If the fish, according to the agreement, state and federal, related to ANILCA, was, yeah, the state had responsibility for managing on federal and state lands that were not parks and special areas.
Right.
And national forests, yeah, all of these places. But that's where it breaks down, is that that got politicized at the head, and then Parnell is worse, and will take the feds to court because we're the state, we have a right to manage wildlife and refuges. Well, they don't. They have the right to recommend and work out some kind of a management agreement, but they have to take into consideration the habitat, which the feds usually know more about on federal lands, but frequently they don't know enough about. And they should have worked together to before they went to, well, if you do that, then the end result is you can't focus on wolf control. You have to focus on all these other factors too.
Right.
Like winter snows and habit overgrazing, browsing by the moose, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which has happened so much on the Kenai particularly, and here as well.
Well, it sounds like it's good you went to that hearing then.
I felt good about it, yeah. And but the problem with something like that is it takes me so long to put together what I want to say, and then it's too much.
Well, so, that's why you hand them the written.
Yeah, but I should be able to boil this thing down to the central points, and then and even for the written.
Yeah, but I mean, 3 minutes is not a lot of time to talk about something that has all the different angles.
They had to shut me off at the end with putting up the zero, and I was one more point, and that one point was on bear baiting.
Right.
But the other, there was so many, the rest of them, I figure, well, no, these two things I wanted to get in there that would help.
Right, that's what I mean.
Done, and it was understood that I had more, and I had handed in the written ones when I did that. But I wanted to do these in a way that showed some understanding of ecosystems and ecology.
Right.
And that's, you can't do that in 3 minutes.
No, not at all.
Right.
Well, I think that's a good summation to end for tonight.
Yeah.
Do you think?
Yeah. Yeah, I think the Boy Scout thing was important.
Okay.
And it's going to be important to my son as an Eagle Scout, you know. And I didn't want to discourage him and scouting, but my wife was disappointed that I didn't become active as a scout leader myself. And, you know, here's your chance to be your dad and son. And it was hard to explain this to her because, yeah, religion was part of it. The Boy Scouts push the religion too.
Yeah.
And the oath, you know, the Boy Scout oath said something, "In God we trust," or something like that. And I was having problems at that age, and why did that have to be in there? And it was too oriented, even in the town, the larger town where I went to high school, where the troops were based. The Catholics had their Boy Scout in their church, and the church that Arg was a congregational one, and this close by was the Cub Scout. Then Mother C lived in, her husband was a Methodist preacher, and she was terrific then Mother, but her son, older son, was one of our
Troops were segregated by religious affiliation?
No, these are host churches that had a place to meet.
I realize that. I know, but were the members of those troops also members of those churches?
No.
So it was therefore unofficially segregated?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, and I don't know about the...
Because you went to the one... What was your mom's church? So you went to one that was the congregation.
No, I know they weren't officially segregated.
I know, but did they sort of, because the churches hosted them?
Not the church that where my troop was. It was
no, but when you were growing up.
No, that's the one I'm talking about.
Right, but that's what I'm wondering is if the church, if there was one at the Methodist, one at the Congregationalist, one at the Catholic, were the members, the boys. Were of those different, if you were a Catholic boy, you didn't go join the Methodist, you didn't go join the Boy Scout troop that met at the Methodist church, did you?
They might have been if they were in that part of the town.
Oh, it was based on...
I think it was based on where, what part of town you're in. But I think, I know that the Catholic, they're in I don't know for sure, but I think... So of my buddies, there were three of us that were of five of us. Yeah, the one whose mom was a Cub Scout, he wasn't in Boy Scouts, I don't think. Mm. But then another close friend, he lived sort of in between, and he went to the closest one to his place. And yet, yeah, and... He was in a different troop than his older brother. Hmm. His older brother had been in my troop.
Oh, I see.
And he was, he became assistant unit leader or scoutmaster, and he was just a terrific guy.
Well, I was going to say, in all cases, the Jews weren't allowed at all.
I don't know. if they identified themselves.
That's the reputation in the Boy Scouts. I don't know that there's fact behind that.
Well, there wasn't, in my family, there wasn't any discrimination.
No, but the reputation of the Boy Scouts is there was a bit, they were discriminatory, and so Jews weren't allowed, blacks weren't allowed in the same way.
But I don't know about the Boy Scout manual. I don't.
Oh, I don't saying it's necessarily was officially stated.
No, but it...
That's the stereotype reputation.
It's certainly the role of God and God we trust and other things for God and stuff. But I don't think that... I think, in fact, that in Boy Scouts isn't as popular in Catholic... community as they were in Protestant community. Mm. That's my guess, although there was a troop for the Catholic Church, and one of our buddies that played basketball with us, he belonged for a short time, but he was so busy doing other things. Yeah.
Even though you had kind of decided you weren't such a fan of Boy Scouts, you still encouraged your son to do it. Or you didn't discourage him?
I didn't discourage him, definitely.
And why did you... You must have seen some benefit of it to him.
Yeah. But I made a decision. I didn't make that decision when I was at that younger age. I didn't make that decision.
No.
And I thought that's the way I felt, and with my own kids, and like my oldest daughter was, you know, because of my wife's involvement in, well, she grew up Baptist, but she went to the University Presbyterian Church, and she became a little more liberal, but not a hell of a lot. And she, you know, had a strong faith. And so the three kids went to Sunday school, and I occasionally went to church when, you know, it was Easter or something like that. And plus, my wife was in the choir and singing choir, and so I'd go there, yeah. And she wanted me to go, and she wanted me to go too because she was proud of the choir.
Right.
And I...
You're being supportive.
Yeah, I was supportive of that. But she made a lot of assumptions that because we, whenever we'd get into the religion thing, before the kids were big enough to be involved in it, you know, then she would, you know, would come through why we were different, and then I'd make my case, and it was like, yeah, but you've had all this education, and she can't argue her position. Well, you can't argue faith.
No.
And she knew that, but on the other hand, it was frustrating for her, and I can understand that. All I could say is, you know, that I feel super tolerant toward faiths and peoples. It's the people that have the faith, and that's fine. And more recently, if someone's asked me if I believe in, and want to discuss it, if I believe in God, and yeah, I believe God is a valid concept that exists in the minds of humans. And it certainly is, as such, it influences society in a great way. So in a sense, yeah, that kind of God with a capital G is a product of our cultural evolution. Mm-hmm. And it's no different from the first people that had something they called something other than God, but right. They provided the answers or right. explanations for what they couldn't explain themselves.
Yeah, and I was asked about the Boy Scouts for your son. That did you feel like you wanted him to have those same experiences in nature and learning about survival and those things? You felt that benefited your life, and you wanted him to experience that also?
Yeah, but I didn't. If I became, which I very easily could have done, became a troop leader, assistant leader, or something like that, then what do you do if there's a prayer when you start?
Right.
What do you do in that case? Do you involve yourself in the prayer, or just you close your eyes, or in a church? I mean, I just I can't bring myself.
Right. Well, but in Boy Scouts, I didn't realize that you'd have to say those. I mean, if you're a troop leader who doesn't believe in the religious aspects of it, could you just not do that part?
It probably varies with troops. Yeah, that's, I mean, that one of the things that, positive things, that these troops were pretty independent. It was only when you get an issue like somebody in the South where blacks might want to, or a female wants to join the Boy Scouts, then it creates problems, or a gay person.
Right.
Well, we had one gay guy in our troop, and I know him pretty well, and it was generally known that he was gay, and people use derogatory terms, and he was a nice guy, but you had to, when you interacted with him, you had to understand that he was pretty immature for a gay person in terms of his age. He should have, he wasn't, and, but he was very sociable, and he was also in the church young people deal was, and they didn't, there was no discrimination against him. And probably not all of them knew he was gay. But,
yeah, they probably didn't know.
But some did. And
But you think your son benefited like you did from the Boy Scouts in terms of appreciation for the outdoors and having those skills? And...
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we did a lot of camping as a family and did sometimes canoe deals for with some of the kids if Arlene was doing something else, or with one, and I'd do it with the other kids. So we were big on that, and then building the cabin out at the lake. I mean, that was a family operation, and they all loved it. And the disappointing thing once when Martin got into the Boy Scouts, then the weekends they would be out to the scout camp. And so it was just the two girls. And he loved the being out there with the family and the girls and the dog. And he was good when it was cutting logs and stuff. And he and I worked together sometimes doing that. And but the pull for him as a young boy was his all these friends and scouts thing, and they had regular weekend outings, and so, yeah, he would go there, and we'd go out to the lake, and sometimes, you know, then he would be there. But sure, that's as families grow up, that happens,
right?
Know? And especially male versus female.
But the girls didn't join Girl Scouts.
No. No, they didn't. And they, but they were pretty busy. They belonged to a swim club before they had swim in schools. And they both girls got to be really good swimmers. And then when they went to high school, West Valley, yeah, and the oldest one, both of them went to West Valley, but Martin went to Lathrop because
West Valley wasn't built yet.
So, but they, Peggy went the first year of high school. Plus, we were in Norway for that year then. But and then Laura, she got on, stayed with the swim team and was a good swimmer and got her. Earned her letter and what. And Peggy was probably a better swimmer, started, but she had had enough of the regimentation of of being a regular for the training and all that.
Right.
She appreciated it, but and she was appreciated that she had learned to be a good swimmer. Went out to the lake, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, all that time at the lake, I'm sure they all were good.
And, you know, see, the last time the family was together out there and when their mom still has that old cabin, the cabin that I built with them, and then I had the other cabin that I have now. And so when we're together, then we can split up where people are sleeping, and that time the guys were all in, and my boys were in my cabin, and I do the big outdoor barbecue for everybody, and then I have to, you know, shuttle people around to get them across the lake, and then breakfast, Arlene would do and make pancakes and blueberry syrup and all that, blueberry pancakes and syrup and all that. And so that it works out well. But the girls, especially Peggy, she loved, she's very artistic, and she'd collect plants and weave little hanging deals and even throw many of them. She'd hang one in the outhouse and things like that. And Laura, both of them, the being out there and swimming was a big deal. But the last time they were up, and when we had all this, got grandkids and everything, Peggy and Rich, she keeps swimming down there, and Homer, and it was exercise,